Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of the presentation, they are as follows. Texas Department of Public Safety versus Melinda Petta from Nueces County, in which we have allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. And then three causes consolidated for the second oral argument, General Services Commission versus Little Tex Insulation Company from Travis County, Texas Department of Transportation versus Air Aerotron Incorporated from Travis County, and Texas A&M University and the Board of Regents of that school from versus Dalmac Construction Company Incorporated, also from Travis County. In that matter, we have allotted 25 minutes for each side to present argument. And finally, St. Joseph Hospital versus Stacy Lynn Wolf and others from Travis County, in which we have allotted 20 minutes. We will take a brief recess in between each argument, and we will complete these arguments in time for lunch. The court is meeting at the University of Texas for the first time, and the recordings will be handled by the University of Texas. But if you wish an audio tape of any of these arguments, you may make application for our with our clerk at the Supreme Court building. If you would like to purchase a videotape of any argument, please contact Hollis Levy at the University of Texas Law School. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Texas Department of Public Safety versus Petta.
May it please the court, Ms. Julie Parsley will present argument from petitioner. She has reserved 5 minutes.
May it please the court. Melinda Petta was convicted of the crime of fleeing from a police officer. That conviction is final and valid. She now asks this court to allow her to bring a civil action that will essentially collaterally attack and call into question the correctness of that conviction. And unless the Court of Appeals judgment is reversed, she will succeed. Texas public policy will not allow Ms. Petta to shift the blame for her criminal conduct from herself to Officer Rivera. Likewise, the judicial principles underlying the preservation and finality of judgments will not allow her claim to go forward.
Counsel?
Yes.
Can we bifurcate the sequence of events and say that what happened before she left the scene may or may not be enough to sustain a cause of action aside from your sovereign immunity argument?
No, Your Honor. Actually, the facts cannot be broken up in this case because the facts that she is presenting to this civil court are the same facts she presented to the criminal court. And the criminal court heard everything from the moment she was pulled over by Officer Rivera for the traffic stop until she pulled into the
apartment
complex.
But she's only charged with fleeing the scene of a stop, I guess is what you call it.
Yes, eluding a police officer.
So when does that offense begin to occur?
Well, the Court of Appeals held, and incorrectly held, that it severed, it cut off at the time she fled. But it's one continuum of facts. The jury, the criminal jury, heard all the facts. They considered all the facts in reaching their verdict. And it cannot be broken up, the claim cannot be broken up at the time that she fled, because
it seems to me, couldn't someone who's arrested for a traffic stop and gets beaten by a police officer have a claim for assault or use of excessive force?
Certainly.
And not be inconsistent with their arrest for the traffic stop?
Certainly, if they were not convicted of having assaulted that officer.
Well, she wasn't convicted of assault. She was convicted of fleeing, and the jury failed to accept her affirmative defense that her fleeing the officer was justified. So there's been no trial relating to the conduct of the police officer in any answer to the factual inquiry of whether or not he used excessive force. Isn't that correct?
No, because his conduct was the centerpiece of her criminal action. Her whole defense was that she had to flee because he was assaulting her and that the assault continued while she was fleeing, which is why she didn't stop.
But even if those two, aren't we looking at different states of mind in these two criminal actions? You're looking at her state of mind in these two actions. In the criminal action, we're looking at her state of mind, and now in the civil action, we'd be looking at his.
It is true that there is a, that the criminal action depended on her reasonable belief, and that the civil act would be his intentional conduct. But his conduct was squarely put into question in the criminal action.
But the jury never answered a question in that case with respect to his conduct specifically. He was not on trial. Isn't that correct?
The jury charge read that if she believed, reasonably believed that she was in fear of imminent bodily harm.
So that means that if it, based on that inquiry, his conduct was not the subject of a fact question that the jury was required to answer.
But his conduct was resolved by the jury. It would
was
have
his was his conduct specifically the subject of a jury question in the criminal trial?
His conduct was not mentioned in the verdict.
But
in the
if
jury
it's
charge.
If it's his state of mind in the civil case, what he understood, as opposed to her state of mind in the criminal case, isn't there a different fact that's being tried in the civil case?
No, Your Honor, because the issues are inextricably intertwined and were fully and fairly litigated in the criminal trial. Her necessity defense is a common law defense, and there's been some confusion on this issue. Ms. Petta alleges that the necessity defense is an affirmative defense, but it is actually a common law defense. If you have an affirmative defense, the burden is on the criminal defendant to both prove and to both put on evidence and prove that defense. However, when you have a common law defense, the criminal defendant is required to put on some evidence of the defense. The burden then shifts to the state to disprove that defense beyond a reasonable doubt. So her defense was fully and fairly litigated and was part of the underlying verdict that she was guilty of the crime.
If the criminal verdict had gone differently, and let's say she had prevailed, would the state then be stopped in a civil proceeding? You could not contest liability?
No, Your Honor. Actually, an acquittal does not pose estoppel. And there is a case that Ms. Petta has cited in other courts, the State versus Gonzalez, where this court held in 1979, I believe, that an acquittal of a criminal action did not work estoppel. But a guilty verdict will. This case is very similar to the Fifth Circuit's decisions in Sappington versus Bartee and Hudson versus Hughes, and is really virtually factually indistinguishable from Hudson versus Hughes. In Hudson versus Hughes, an inmate, during an arrest, critically beat an officer and was charged and convicted of that offense. In his defense during that trial, he claimed self-defense, but he was still convicted. The jury rejected his self-defense claim. He later brought a 1983 action claiming that the officer had used excessive force against him in effecting the arrest. The Fifth Circuit held that because his civil contentions would work to undermine and put in question the validity of his conviction, that was barred. He could not collaterally attack his criminal conviction by putting it into question because a civil verdict could not exist in the same universe as the criminal conviction.
What legal principle are you relying upon to say that there can't be a collateral attack? Collateral estoppel? Res judicata?
Collateral estoppel.
Principle? You're asking us to apply collateral estoppel. What is the identity of issues that are at play in the criminal and civil action?
The identity of issues is that she argued that his tortious acts caused her to believe that she was going to suffer imminent bodily harm. In the criminal trial, that was her showing. In the civil case, she would have to show that he knowingly and intentionally threatened to use imminent bodily harm.
That sounds like two different issues to me. Why are they the same?
They're the same because the same issues, the same exact conduct, the same exact issues are going to be decided for both.
But the issue you described as to her talks about her state of mind and whether she was justified by what the officer did in fleeing. That's different than what's at issue here, which is the officer's state of mind and his conduct and how he dealt with her. How can those two things be the same when you are judging a different state of mind?
In the civil context, it will be his intentional conduct. In the criminal context, it was just her reasonable belief. Arguably, the civil context for requiring her to prove his intentional conduct is a higher standard than her just putting forth evidence of the defense that she reasonably believed that he was threatening her.
Let me focus your answer here. In a civil assault case, the plaintiff doesn't have to prove that they believed they were going to be assaulted. They only have to prove that the defendant took some action with the intent that they fear Can't she try the entire civil case on simply what the police officer intended to do? And if the police officer attempted to bring in evidence about what, whether she reasonably believed or not, would be irrelevant to the outcome of the case, wouldn't it?
No, Your Honor, because she would have to, and this turns to the public policy issue.
So you're saying it's a defense, you're saying it would be a defense to her assault claim if the defendant could show she really didn't believe she'd be assaulted?
No, that would not be, that would be part of, I suppose, a defense to, it would be a defense, I suppose, that she didn't reasonably believe, but that is not what the intentional act is going to look at. It's going to look at his intent as opposed to her reasonable belief, and that is true. But the fact issues were necessarily subsumed in the civil trial, and if the civil, I mean in the criminal trial, if the civil action goes forward and allows Melinda Petta to put on evidence of her criminal act of fleeing and say, he made me do it, that will necessarily impugn the criminal verdict. And public policy will not allow her to shift the blame for her conduct from herself to him in a civil action.
The issues were subsumed in the criminal trial, but that's drawn by inference and perhaps by facts, not by any kind of thing in the verdict.
The verdict found that she was guilty of the offense, that's correct, and that, but they had to necessarily reject her defense, which was based on his alleged assault.
Why do you say they necessarily had to reject her defense, since there was no finding on it?
If they believed, the way the jury charge read, if they had a reasonable doubt that she had fled because of his acts, they were to acquit her. But because if they believed the state disproved her defense beyond a reasonable doubt, they were to convict her.
But he still could have assaulted her, and the jury have found that she was not justified in fleeing. Isn't that correct? That doesn't mean there wasn't an assault, does it?
It would, Your Honor, mean there wasn't an assault, because the jury's verdict has to be considered to be reasonable, and it would be difficult.
What are the elements of an assault in a civil matter?
They are essentially the same as they are in a criminal matter under
what?
The penal code. They are that the person intentionally or knowingly threatened the victim with imminent bodily harm, and therefore they are essentially the same. Her defense was that she reasonably believed that he was threatening her with imminent bodily harm, but the conviction and the civil trial cannot necessarily coexist in the same universe, because she is going to have to argue that her criminal acts were justified by what he did in the civil trial, which would impermissibly put in question her conviction.
Ms. Parsley, let's assume that we reject your argument that collateral estoppel bars her claim. You also argue that under the public policy doctrine, her lawsuit should be barred. I'm concerned about the limits or the breadth of that kind of argument. What limits, if we were to adopt it, what limits should this court impose in embracing that kind of policy or argument?
The same limits the court placed on it in Peeler, that if there is an adjudication of innocence or if the criminal conviction is found to be somehow invalid, it would not work an estoppel. That there would not be it could not be collaterally attacked by the civil judgment. This court has put an innocence requirement on the public policy defense, and it would be the same limit that we would argue here. Turning to the tort
claim.
Wouldn't
that give the law enforcement officers carte blanche? I mean, someone could be guilty of a crime, but there could be excessive force used in the arrest. How would you distinguish those cases?
Those cases could be distinguished by the question of whether the criminal defendant had been charged and convicted of assaulting the officer during the crime, during the arrest.
They just fled, and in the course of, they committed a crime, they fled, they were apprehended, but in the course of being apprehended, they were beaten by the police officers. Now, if we adopted your public policy defense, wouldn't we say that since they're guilty of a crime, they get what they deserve, basically?
No, because they're not guilty of a crime that would call into question the excessive force used during the arrest. Their guilt would be dependent on whatever their crime initially was, the burglary, whatever.
They're fleeing, and they're apprehended, and they're beaten. Under your theory, wouldn't the state have no liability for excessive force?
No, No, ma'am, not unless that the actual excessive force was what caused the defendant to flee, and then the criminal jury found that that was and rejected that defense. It would be limited to these facts where the defense was squarely put in issue, fairly and fully litigated, and then found against the criminal defendant. Quickly turning to the Tort Claims Act, it does not waive sovereign immunity for the claims against Department of Public Services safety. The Tort Claims Act waives sovereign immunity only for certain acts, and it is limited in its waiver. It does not waive liability for intentional torts. The Court of Appeals avoided the intentional tort exception by construing the claims against DPS as arising from negligent conduct that preceded an intentional tort, trying to draw this case into line with the Delaney case. But this case is very different from the Delaney set of facts.
So excessive force cases will always be intentional torts and will always be protected by the Tort Claims Act?
No, Your Honor, that's no.
Where this, do you draw the line?
Well, she is not claiming excessive force. She's claiming an assault and battery, which is specifically exempted. If she had brought a valid 1983 claim for excessive force, she would show that her constitutional right had been violated and that he had caused that violation.
And if it were an excessive force case, how would it fall out under the Tort Claims Act?
I see I've run out of time. May I answer?
Please.
The excessive force claim under the Tort Claims Act would not... It would depend on the employee's negligence. If he had committed an intentional act, then it would not be permissible under the Tort Claims Act. The remedy would be under Section 1983 against that officer.
I'm just trying to figure out, in the run-of-the-mill case like this, if you can call these run-of-the-mill cases, how they are to be prosecuted in the future. If somebody is subjected to what could be categorized as excessive force or assault and battery, if somebody is beat by a police officer, there seems to be that they should have some right of recovery. And the question is, what avenue is pursued to do that? Which leads to the question is, to what extent does the Tort Claims Act cloak the governmental entity with protection? And so if you could answer that to the broader context of these cases, whenever there is conduct like this in general, how does the Tort Claims Act provide a shield to the governmental entity? Is it your contention that it always would, or are you saying that there would be some exceptions?
It would depend on the facts of the case. If the employee's conduct was intentional, and it was an intentional assault and battery, the Tort Claims Act would not waive liability in that case.
So by saying that, you're saying that there can be some assault and batteries that are not intentional?
No, I apologize if that's what I said. That's not what I meant to say. The assault and battery... If it was an assault and battery, if it was unreasonable force and was found to be assault, then it would not waive sovereign immunity under the Tort Claims Act. If, however, it was negligent conduct or something that was lesser than the intentional act, then it possibly could subject the governmental unit to liability under the Tort Claims Act. But the Tort Claims Act clearly does not waive sovereign immunity for assault or battery on behalf of the employee. Now, the employee might personally be liable in their individual capacity for the assault and battery, and that is always possible because it's difficult to see how they would have official immunity for that act. But the governmental entity is not going to be liable for that intentional conduct.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May please the court, Mr. James D. Mount, Jr.
Mr. Mount, what was Ms. Petta convicted of?
She was convicted of fleeing or attempting to elude a police officer, which is a misdemeanor.
Isn't that a continuum? It wasn't fleeing the scene. It was fleeing all the way until she got to her driveway, correct?
I wouldn't agree that it was a continuum. I believe that you could look at this particular incident in separate, discrete parts. For instance, in order for her to be convicted, she has to actually be fleeing or attempting to elude the officer.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Her accident occurred prior.
Until she went and entered her driveway, she was fleeing the entire time.
That is correct. She was fleeing the entire time.
And so that whole continuum was an offense.
That is correct.
Well, then that would make the distinction the Court of Appeals drew in this case invalid, wouldn't it? Because didn't the Court of Appeals presume that the offense occurred at the scene and that after that there was a discrete segment in time that it presumes was not part of the offense?
I'm not sure if that's what the Court of Appeal held or not as far as when they decided the particular incident occurred as far as the fleeing.
But if they drew that type of distinction, you would think that would be invalid then?
That's correct. Okay.
Mr. Mount, I'm having a hard time understanding or finding the waiver of sovereign immunity here. Can we talk about that? Where is the waiver in the statute?
We certainly can. And under the Texas Tort Claims Act, we have Section 101.021, 1 and 2, dealing with tangible property in a motor-driven vehicle also. The instruments that he used with Ms. Petta, the nightstick, the gun that he also used, and the vehicle that he used.
Weren't all of these intentional acts?
As far as we're concerned, these either could have been intentional acts or they could have been negligent acts. We're not sure at this particular point in time.
How can you be negligent taking your nightstick and beating it on the window of a car?
That was Melinda's contention, that he was beating the nightstick on the vehicle. However, the officer's contention, though, was that he was tapping it on the car. So
assume we agree with you. Assume we say, okay, well, you can put all this into the category of negligence. All your client has claimed are emotional injuries, and there is no cause of action in Texas for negligent infliction of emotional distress. So don't you lose under a negligence theory?
I believe that in Texas, under the Transportation Code, there's a duty on behalf of the police officers to drive with the due regard or safety of motorists on the road. So there's been a legal duty that's been created.
But there's no injury. We don't recognize in Texas a cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress. So if we assume you're correct, hasn't your client only alleged emotional injuries?
Absent another legal duty, though, there is a legal duty under the Texas Transportation Code, which would allow us to bring this particular claim. It would be the breach of that particular duty that would allow this negligent infliction of emotional distress type of claim.
Do you have any authority for that proposition?
Yes, I do. It was cited in the first PETA opinion, the 96 opinion.
Why is that statute any different from a common law breach of duty? Why should we say there's no cause of action for emotional distress for a breach of a common law duty, but for some reason we should say the statute reaches a different result or causes a different result?
Well, I believe it's because we have a statute involved. We actually have a legal duty that's created versus what we have under the common law.
So it's your position that every time there's a violation of a statute, you can recover for emotional injuries?
In this particular instance, as far as the violation of this particular statute, I would say yes. But as far as other statutes, we would have to look at those particular statutes.
Mr. Mount, there's a Fifth Circuit case, I guess, Sappington, I think is the name of it. And it really doesn't talk in terms of collateral estoppel. It really just talks in terms of whether or not a decision in the civil case would be inconsistent with a decision in the criminal case. And so how could Ms. Petta's judgment against Officer Rivera for assault against her, assuming she gets a judgment against him, for assault not establish that she was justified to be fleeing from him? How could that not establish her justification in fleeing?
Well, I think that the definition of assault, we have three different types of assault, that the assault definition is much broader than the necessity instruction that was given in our particular case. In our particular criminal case, the necessity instruction was tied to the flight. So I believe that we have a narrower.
So you're arguing that at some discrete point in time he could have assaulted her, but the assault would have been such that she would not have otherwise been justified in fleeing?
I believe that's right.
Which point in fleeing the police officer would she have not been justified in fleeing if he had assaulted her?
Could you repeat that question?
The state's position is you're trying to create a discrete event. He shot at the car. and that was an assault. And therefore, to find that that was an assault would not be inconsistent with the finding that she wasn't justified in fleeing the officer. The state says you can't do that. You can't separate those. So I'm asking now to give me the point in time that the police officer could have assaulted her, but she would not have been justified in fleeing a police officer.
If you look at the issue, she was shot at prior to being fleeing. She wasn't participating in that particular crime.
If I was just sitting in my car and all of a sudden somebody started shooting at me, I think I'd flee. So how is that not justification for fleeing?
We're not sure what was in her mind at the time, whether that's what caused her to flee, whether it was that particular shot that caused her to flee, or whether it was some other event that occurred at the time that caused her to flee. We're not sure what the finding is in that area.
But isn't that kind of critical in this case? The argument you make is that there could have been an assault occurring that would not have justified her fleeing a police officer. And so wouldn't it be critical to identify when that assault occurred so that you could determine that it's not inconsistent with the jury's determination she wasn't justified in fleeing?
In this particular case, we don't know what it was, though, that caused her to decide to flee. We just don't know that.
Well, can a jury... Let's assume the jury finds civil assault, an intentional event that the police officer commits with the intent to harm her, and the jury says, yes, that occurred, and here's the damages. If that all occurred, if all those elements were proven, wouldn't the person who was assaulted have a reasonable belief that they were being assaulted? If you proved that this was intentional and intended to do that, wouldn't you have a reasonable belief that you're going to be assaulted?
I believe so, yes.
So how is the civil judgment not inconsistent with the criminal conviction that said she wasn't justified in fleeing?
Well, the civil judgment just limits, it was the finding of the criminal court that if Melinda believed her flight was necessary to avoid imminent harm, that belief was not reasonable. It didn't foreclose a jury finding that she wasn't harmed by what he was doing, or it doesn't mean that he didn't do what he said he did, that he chased her at a high speed, that he shot at her, that he used his nightstick on her. It doesn't mean that he didn't scare her to death, and it doesn't mean that he wasn't negligent.
If he was scaring her to death, she didn't have a reasonable fear of imminent harm?
That is only in context. That would be in context with the flight, with the flight only. I think you have to limit.
I don't understand that answer. If he was scaring her to death, she didn't have a reasonable fear of imminent harm, wherever it occurred.
That would be only right, but it would only be in connection with the flight, not what occurred. I believe prior to her fleeing.
Well, how can that be?
I believe just what you're looking at is under that necessity instruction. That's just a much narrower instruction than what you have under the.
In your brief, you say for Ms. Petta to have been found not guilty, the criminal jury would have had to have found that Ms. Petta reasonably believed that her flight was immediately necessary to avoid imminent harm. I think that's right. And a corollary to that is, since the jury found that she was guilty, it had to find beyond a reasonable doubt, right? It had to find beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's correct.
Burden was on the prosecution that her flight was not immediately necessary to avoid imminent harm. Now, how could they find that if he was doing any of the things that you're going to claim he was doing in the civil action?
Well, I believe the jury didn't believe that her flight was necessary to avoid imminent harm. It doesn't mean that Melinda wasn't harmed. She wasn't being harmed by this officer, or she wasn't in harm's way at the time. It's just that her flight wasn't necessary to avoid that imminent harm. Again, it doesn't mean that she wasn't harmed, that she wasn't injured at all.
So he was beating on her window with the stick. He was shooting at her, but she didn't have any reasonable belief that she was in danger.
No, I think she did have a reasonable belief that she was in danger when she was being beaten upon at that particular point in time.
The criminal jury said that beyond a reasonable doubt, she didn't.
But again, they tie it to her flight also. They again, it's tied to the flight.
I want to make sure I understand your position. Are you just suing for the pre-flight conduct of Rivera or conduct that goes beyond the flight?
We're suing for the entire conduct.
Would you go back to the immunity question? Is the basis of your argument that you get a waiver of immunity because of your assertion this is negligent use of tangible personal property? Is that correct?
That's correct. And also,
is that the only basis for waiver?
We believe that the property was used negligently, but also if there was a finding by the jury that this property was used intentionally, we believe that the DBS could have still been responsible for what occurred on that particular day. That is, the DPS could still be responsible for their own negligent acts under the Sheridan versus United States case, and also this court's authority in Delaney versus City of Houston. We believe that the DPS was negligent in allowing this incident to occur, allowing this chase to escalate the way it did. There's evidence in the file that reflects that one of the superiors who investigated this incident afterwards says that maybe this chase should have been broken off. The DPS had, at the time of the chase, they had her driver's license and all the information necessary to identify this particular lady and pick her up at another time.
In fact, didn't DPS instruct the officer not to do what he did? So, again, how could DPS be negligent in implementing its policies if it followed them and specifically instructed the officer?
DPS did not ask the officer to break off the chase or any of the other officers to break off the chase. The only thing the DPS asked him to do was not to shoot at her particular vehicle, which evidently he violated that particular order and did shoot.
Okay, let's limit it to that then. Surely that would be covered by immunity. I mean, there can be no negligence in failing to follow or implement their policies if they instructed him not to shoot.
He felt like that when that order was given that the situation had changed at that particular point in time. So he possibly the order wasn't clear enough that under no circumstance should you shoot at this particular vehicle. Because apparently he didn't shoot right after that order was given, but at a later point in time when he felt like it was okay to shoot. So there might have been some ambiguity as far as that particular order was concerned.
But if we applied that reasoning, wouldn't the exception swallow the rule? If we can always craft some sort of negligence claim for negligent implementation of policy when what clearly is an intentional act on his behalf?
I don't agree with that statement because in this particular case, again, you've got tangible personal property involved, so you do have a limitation. You've got this property that's being used. If we argue that it was being used intentionally, the point of the matter was that this particular individual the other argument that we have in our briefing materials, I believe, is that he wasn't properly trained by the DPS, which he evidently wasn't trained.
Well, but how can you get that under negligent use of tangible personal property when no personal property per se is involved in training? Or how does that couple to get you a waiver?
Well, there is a nexus between the property that he needs to be trained in the use of his vehicle. He needs to be trained in the use of his nightstick and his gun as to how to handle these items and when to use them. In civil litigation, you have situations where you might entrust or give to someone your vehicle that you know is not qualified to drive that particular vehicle. He might deliberately go out and run a red light.
Well,
you're
but
be
that,
responsible for that.
That analogy doesn't work because in negligent entrustment of a motor vehicle, you have to show actual knowledge of the poor driving record or whatever. And so how can you couple that with the claim negligent supervision can get you to negligent use of tangible personal property to get the waiver?
If you have knowledge that this particular person... Officer Rivera was not properly trained concerning these particular items, then you're negligent in allowing him to go out and use these.
Thus far, that's merely an allegation. There's no evidence to that effect. Is that right?
Well, there's evidence out there that reflects that they gave him additional training afterwards because they felt like apparently that he didn't have significant enough training
in that
beforehand.
Remedial.
It could be
steps. Is that admissible?
Could be remedial, but it also could be an acknowledgement of the fact that he hadn't been properly trained in the first place. I believe also his personnel file reflects that there were other incidences of where there was rude behavior on his part. Perhaps he should have had more training at that particular time when those other incidences developed.
Mr. Mount, let's assume that he was given the best training available, and he still acted in the manner that he did. But would the result be different? Would you still be making a claim against EPS?
As far as the training claim goes, I believe we wouldn't be, because it wouldn't be foreseeable that this particular incident would occur. But if you have an unqualified officer out there using these particular items, then we believe it is foreseeable that something like this could happen. The last thing I'd like to touch on is also the public policy issue. We believe that policy issue, that public policy is a very narrow doctrine that should not be applied in this particular case. The key
let me ask you in that regard, do you agree that in Sappington they're really talking about a public policy concern as opposed to collateral estoppel? In other words, the issue that's addressed is not that collateral estoppel prevents the plaintiff, Ms. Pettit, in this case, from relitigating issue, but it's really a public policy concern that the issues are so closely intertwined that one necessarily means you couldn't have had the other.
I would agree with that.
And then you're proceeding to argue that that's a very narrow issue that doesn't apply here.
Well, what I'm trying to argue is that public policy, I believe, is much narrower than the collateral estoppel type of doctrine. In the public policy arena, in this particular doctrine, we don't believe that Melinda Petta contributed in any way to her injury. That is, her fleeing contributed in any way to what Rivera did to her. So we believe that public policy wouldn't apply in this particular case. Rivera beat on her vehicle, evidently he shot at her. All these were acts by Rivera towards her that didn't have anything to do with her illegal act. And then also concerning the public policy doctrine, you have incidents, you have matters that occurred prior to her fleeing also.
Let me ask you about that. If she flees, I mean, I understand she wants to talk about certain discrete events, but police officer comes, stops her, she decides that there's something wrong here, and she drives away. Now, the police officer has the authority to take reasonable steps to apprehend her. Correct. So isn't she, in fact, creating the circumstance that then calls upon the police officer to start exercising discretion to arrest and apprehend?
I don't necessarily agree. I believe he should have acted properly under that particular circumstance. The officer apparently didn't do that in this instance.
Well, if he'd acted appropriately under the circumstance, he would have had the authority to stop and apprehend her.
That's correct.
So is she not contributing to her injury by initiating a sequence of events that escalates?
I don't believe so, because it's his conduct towards her that we see in this particular instance. It's his conduct that needs to be addressed.
In the context of his apprehending her? He stopped her for a traffic event. She flees, he apprehends her, she argues that a number of these factors are assaults, but you don't perceive her fleeing as initiating any of those sequences.
No, I don't, because it's, again, we're looking at his conduct towards her. We're not looking at her particular act. She's not contributing to the incident through her illegal conduct.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Parsley, let me ask you the converse of a question I asked you earlier. What if her civil case had gone to trial first and she had prevailed? Would she be acquitted on the criminal charge? Would she have established her necessity defense?
That could have come in at the criminal trial, probably as an impeachment of his evidence, of his testimony, but it would not have necessarily compelled a result in the criminal trial. The collateral estoppel applying from criminal to civil has been held to apply from criminal to civil, but I'm unaware of any cases where it's applied from civil back to criminal again.
So under your argument, it's really just a one-way street. There's no way. I mean, that undercuts your argument, doesn't it, that they're inextricably intertwined and a decision on one precludes a decision on the other?
Well, let me rephrase my answer. I am not aware of any case where it has gone the other way. And so the courts, as far as I know, have not held that. But the principles would be the same. They are still inextricably intertwined. At a minimum, her acquittal, her civil conviction would come in to impeach whatever testimony he would have, if not to come in to show that she had been assaulted. So I think that would be possible. But I don't know of any cases.
Another but you're not going to allow it to go the other way from criminal to civil. You're saying in your argument that as a matter of law, it just stops without having the opportunity for the state to come in and impeach her civil action by saying, well, here's what the jury found over there. It's just a legal question rather than an evidentiary question if it goes the other way. I think that's what Justice O'Neill is getting at.
Under our arguments, that would be true. However, there are the Heck versus Humphrey line of cases, Sappington and Hudson, apply the basic premise of collateral estoppel of not letting the criminal judgment be attacked by a civil judgment without requiring an exact identity of issues. And so there is also that line of cases that would support our argument, as well as public policy, which, although the Court of Appeals and Ms. Petta argue she was not a willing participant in her injuries, that language is taken from the Gulf case, which was a totally different circumstance. In that case, a gambler was suing his landlord for some damage to his property. The landlord argued that the gambler could not bring the civil action because the gambler was engaged in illegal conduct.
I understood the argument to be following the Heck case and Sappington, where the evidence of the case had to do with the defendant assaulting a police officer, and this police officer using force to subdue the defendant, and the defendant brings an assault claim, and the court saying, but since the police officer is authorized to take the steps necessary, one of the factors is that the defendant contributed to the defendant's own injuries.
Correct.
And so that was a common thread in the Sappington type cases.
That's correct.
Mr. Mount now argues on behalf of Ms. Petta that she was just driving down the road. There was a dispute over how fast she was going, but the police officer immediately pounced on her and threatened her and was beating on her window, and that was an event that occurred without her contributing the injury, and therefore the public policy of Sappington, Heck, should not apply in this case.
But it should apply because Sappington and Hudson are almost identical to this set of facts. That's exactly what the defendants in the plaintiff in the civil actions tried to allege, is that they didn't do anything wrong. They were pounced on. Excessive force was used against them during the arrest, and that's what caused the action. That's what caused them to have to react to the police officer and beat the police officer. It's exactly the same set of facts here. She will have to rely on her illegal acts in her civil trial to prove her civil cause of action. She will have to say, I fled because he assaulted me. And her excuse for fleeing in the civil action will necessarily impugn her conviction in the criminal.
Why does she have to prove anything about her fleeing in connection with the civil action?
She has to prove that he intentionally and knowingly threatened her with imminent bodily harm. And her set of facts
I understand, but why does she have to? You just said that she has to prove that she fled because she was in fear of bodily harm. Why would she have to prove anything about her flight in connection with the civil action?
Because her assault claims continue past the flight and through the chase. Her claims encompass the entire continuum of facts. From the time she stopped, she fled, during the flight, and the time she was apprehended.
Ms. Parsley, if the officer had been convicted of criminal assault, would he be stopped from relitigating the issue of whether he had assaulted her in a civil action by her?
Yes.
I have one more question for you. If we decide that that DPS is entitled to sovereign immunity, do we reach collateral estoppel?
The DPS immunity does not necessarily encompass the claims against Rivera in his individual capacity, although under 101-106 of the Tort Claims Act, he would be entitled to judgment. But DPS and Rivera in his individual capacity did not assert that.
That's my question. That issue would not really be before us, it would be more advisory if we wrote on collateral estoppel in that context, correct?
Not necessarily, because the case can be disposed of either way. The case, well, the entire case can be disposed of as on collateral estoppel or public policy, and then the DPS claims against DPS and Rivera in his official capacity would be resolved in the Tort Claims Act context, which would then require a showing under 101-106, and Rivera would get a judgment in his individual capacity.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. We'll take a brief recess.